WGTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program online at carthage.edu/aspire. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
I am tremendously honored to be speaking for the next few minutes with Julius Lester, a very compelling author of various books which tell the story of African Americans. And he is responsible for a number of award-winning books, including the Newbery Honor Book, To Be a Slave, the Caldecott Honor Book, John Henry, the National Book Award finalist, Long Journey Home, and most recently, a beautiful book called Let's Talk About Race. Julius Lester is a well-known figure in a number of different ways, and for over three decades on the faculty at the University of Massachusetts. And Julius Lester, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And it is great to have this opportunity to talk with you. We've had several interviews as of late about, in light of Martin Luther King Day, about Dr. King and the civil rights movement in general. And it occurs to me now as I sit down to speak with you for the next few minutes that one of the things basically left out of the equation in all of these conversations that we've had, compelling as they have been, has been children and talking with children about matters relating to race and prejudice. Tell us, first of all, the special challenges that are involved in trying to approach topics like this when writing to or speaking with, for that matter, children.
Well, I think the primary challenge is one of simply finding the right language in which to speak to children about issues, to do so in a way that a child can grasp and understand. And so that one, the way that I do that in many of the books that I write is to make it personal to the child. And so that in the book, Let's Talk About Race, which is for children ages 4 to 7, I begin the book by talking about the fact that I'm a story, that everybody is a story. And so I then go on to present different elements of my story, where I was born, when I was born, what my parents did, what my hobbies are, my favorite colors, and all those kinds of things which are common to anybody's story. And then I mention, I'm also black. And so what I'm doing is really not making my race the central fact of my identity, but simply making it one facet of my identity. And so I think that making it personal to a child gives the child a way in, gives the child a way of relating, gives the child a way of seeing how this applies to me.
One of the most striking moments in the book is when you raise the obvious reality to us, and maybe for a young child it might not yet be an obvious reality, the fact that some people say that their race, their own race, is better than another race.
Right.
And then you pose the question, why would some people say that their race is better than another? And I think your answer is exactly right, but it nonetheless comes a little bit as a surprise to me as I read the next page. Tell us your answer to that question and why you answer the question the way you do.
Well, one way that I answer the question by saying that sometimes people say that that their race is better is because they are afraid. And then, but ultimately, the ultimate answer is simply because there's really no reason why someone should say that except that they want to feel superior to other people. That certainly Western history had defined whiteness as being better than anything that was not white. And I think that those kind of that kind of a definition really comes out of a fear of difference, a fear of not being in control. But ultimately, prejudice is irrational.
I mean, I find that very striking that, you know, your initial answer is, you know, why do they, because they feel bad about themselves, because they are afraid. In a sense, it's a very sympathetic way, in a sense, to look at racial prejudice. And not everybody takes the time to think about it in those kind of terms.
Well, that's a very, very good description. I don't think that dialogue between people of various races is really fostered by anger, by recrimination, by accusing people of being racist or this, that, or the other. I think that one of the things that make Dr. King so effective was that Dr. King was certainly angry about the way things were in America at that time, but that he did not direct that anger at individuals. He directed his anger at the injustices. And so that I think that the attitude that we bring to the conversation have to be ones of sympathy and empathy for the other people involved in the conversation.
We're speaking with Julius Lester, and we're talking about his book, which is a beautiful children's book, although I think a whole lot of people need to read this book. It's called Let's Talk About Race. At one point in the book, you suggest that whoever is reading it should help you with what you call a true story, and you want them to do a little experiment which really can lead one to a profound understanding about us as human beings. Tell us what the reader is supposed to do.
Well, what I ask the reader to do is to take their hands and to press against their cheek or press someplace on their face and to press hard enough until they feel the bone beneath the skin. And then I ask them to do the same thing with to press on the face of a parent or a friend or what have you and feel the bone beneath that person's skin. And then to realize that beneath the skin, we all look the same. Beneath the skin, that we are all comprised of very hard bone, and that if we all took our skins off, you could not tell who was male, who was female, who was black, white, Asian, Hispanic, or what have you. And so then why don't we simply stop putting value judgments on race and simply begin to treat each other in terms of the reality. And the reality is that, you know, we're the same underneath the skin.
Well, and that we are so much more than our race. You say at one point, your race is not all that you are. My race is not all that I am. Yes, I am black, but I am also a man. I am of medium height. I have a deep voice and a loud laugh. I love to laugh to you. I live in a big house in the woods in a small town. I like pancakes and macaroni and cheese. And we flip the page, and you say, I am so, so, so many things besides my race. You know, as I think about the interviews I've done over the last several days, and I think about the audio recordings of Bull Connor from the heart of the Deep South at the height of the Civil War, civil rights movement, I wonder what difference might it have made if Bull Connor had held in his hands a book like this, which might have helped him look at the whole issue of race differently than he and so many other people did.
Well, I don't know that somebody like Bull Connor that it would have made any difference for. Unfortunately, there are people who might look at this book and it not mean anything at all to them. They would reject it entirely. But, you know, I'm an idealist, and so maybe it would have made a difference to Bull Connor, because what I'm saying is seems to me to be so simple and so obvious, and the scientific information that we're getting from the DNA studies and the genome studies tell us that 99% of our genetic makeup is identical. And so that why can't we focus on that 99% rather than focus on the 1% that is different?
We should mention that this book is a beautiful thing to behold, aside from your very meaningful text. Tell us about the illustrations of the book and the talented woman responsible for them.
The artist is Karen Barber, and I've never met her. And she just did a wonderful, wonderful job of illustrating the book in a way that it is just a very happy, joyous book to look at and to hold. And it definitely complements the words and extends the words in terms of the kind of emotion I want children and parents to leave with when they finish the book, which is simply the joy of being alive.
One last question, if I may.
Sure.
I think one mistake which a lot of adults make, and I'm probably one of them, is that when we take a children's book in hand, we maybe don't think, I could do that. But I think most adults have little or no sense of the challenges that are involved in writing a children's book. I think we assume that it is a lot easier than it actually is. I mean, you can take in hand some big 1,000-page biography of Winston Churchill and think, wow, that is a real accomplishment. But I don't think we necessarily appreciate the accomplishment that a very, very good children's book represents. Just try to give us some sense of what makes writing a very good children's book a challenge in order to do it well.
Well, I appreciate your comment, and your observations are quite accurate. Writing children's books are very, very difficult, primarily because children are such a demanding audience. And children are far more demanding audiences than adults. They are much more severe critics than adults. And you really have to write in such a way that it really involves children in a serious way, whether you're writing a serious book or whether you're writing a book that has a lot of humor in it. Children are a tough audience. And I love the challenge of writing for children. And if children are introduced to good literature when they're young, then they will continue to read good literature throughout their lives.
Well, I certainly hope a lot of children will have the opportunity to read this beautiful book called Let's Talk About Race. It's published by HarperCollins Publishers, and its author, Julius Lester. Julius Lester, my congratulations to you. A great pleasure to speak with you about your book on this morning show. I thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for a very thoughtful interview.
The time is 8:22. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Here's part two.
I'm Gregory Berg. The following Morning Show interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2017. Enjoy.
I've been reading a very thought-provoking book called Deep Survival. Who lives, who dies, and why? True stories of miraculous endurance and sudden death. The author is Lawrence Gonzalez, contributing editor for National Geographic Adventure magazine, an author several times over. And this book is certainly an intriguing one, springing to some extent out of some personal experiences of Mr. Gonzalez himself and maybe family members and friends and so on, as he tries to confront what is really a question which has been raised before, but I'm not sure ever in quite such a profound way before. What is it that allows certain people to survive great danger, to emerge from the wreckage of a crash which claims the lives of everyone else? What is going on there? And Lawrence Gonzalez, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much.
Your book begins in extraordinary fashion with an incredible story told by your father, Federico Gonzalez.
Right.
Tell us that story briefly, if you would.
My father was a World War II combat pilot. He flew B-17s for the 8th Air Force in the closing years of the war. And on his 25th mission, which is to say the one that should have been his last, in fact was his last, he was shot down. He had his left wing blown off. And the plane rolled upside down and began spinning. They were at 27,000 feet. And it spun so violently that it tore the plane apart. There was nothing really left except the cockpit, and he wasn't able to get to his parachute. and essentially fell that 27,000 feet with no aid of aeronautics or parachute, and was the only survivor of the 10-man crew, very badly busted up, taken prisoner by the Germans, and spent the rest of the war there. The story obviously is much more detailed than that in the book, but that in itself is something remarkable that as a little child I heard about, and it was almost too fantastic to believe, and yet the older I got, the more I realized, wow, it's really true. That really happened to him.
Hmm. Well, and you started to wonder, did he have some particular sort of quality which allowed him to survive when others did not?
Well, and I address this in the book. You know, I think his real survival journey was not surviving the crash. I think it was rebuilding his life after coming back. That was the true long survival journey that he had to go on. And everything that I've learned over 30 years of studying this stuff tells me that people who are willing to undertake that kind of long survival journey as a way of life are the people who do best when emergency situations come upon them, whether it's, you know, being diagnosed with cancer or finding yourself in the World Trade Center. These are the people who tend to get out.
One of the things you say, I think is worth talking about briefly, is that every survival situation is the same in its essence, and so there are lessons to be learned.
Right.
I'm sure to some extent that's true, although, of course, there are certain survival scenarios in which survival probably has nothing to do with anything except luck, and
yes,
other situations where actually it is determined by other factors over which we have at least some control.
Yes. You know, if a 747 comes out of the sky and hits your house, this is not a situation that you can control. But most survival situations are not like that. First of all, most accidents aren't really accidents. They're carefully assembled by little decisions we make, little omissions we make that in and of themselves mean nothing, but put together add up to a pretty serious situation. But then when I say all survival situations are alike, I'm referring to the spiritual journey that these people go on when they face tremendous challenges. I can, for example, show you a case of a man in Auschwitz who goes through the same sort of spiritual transformation that a man now, today, goes through when he breaks his leg on top of a mountain in Peru. In order to get himself out. And in many cases, they even use the same sort of language to describe what they were going through. And so it says to me that there is some sort of universal journey that we go on when we face these tremendous challenges. And I refer in the book to Native American rites of vision quests, you know, where a young man would go out in the desert and fast for several days in search of a vision. I believe putting yourself under this kind of stress, whether voluntarily or not, brings out certain survival mechanisms in you that trigger these things. And those who are going to get through it respond in a very patterned way. It's fascinating.
Hmm. This is as good a time as any to kind of probe the means by which you put this book together, which includes all kinds of stories of survival. First of all, how did you find these many and varied people with whom you spoke?
Well, I have been studying accidents for over 30 years, and when I started doing what I guess you might call adventure travel writing, I began collecting these stories because they fascinated me. I've always been interested in this. And so gradually I began winnowing them down. I read all the literature, accident reports that come in from various places, and just sort of pick the ones for which there was an account, you know, a decent account, and in many cases picked ones where I could actually find the person. But this is just a fragment of what's out there. I mean, there are thousands of stories that I didn't include.
I wonder, as you speak with people about these kind of incidents, what is the possibility that people are not entirely truthful? And of course, that can occur for a couple of different reasons, that sometimes we embroider what occurs to us and paint ourselves in more heroic terms than perhaps we deserve, or in many cases, because there is such trauma involved in these kind of events, one might not really exactly recall correctly just what occurred and why one survived. As someone responsible for this book and its trustworthiness, how did you handle that?
Well, I mentioned this in the book that, you know, every eyewitness account is different. Any forensic psychologist will tell you people remember things differently. You know, if you have an incident among a group of eyewitnesses, they'll all give you different accounts of what happened. So there is that problem. On the other hand, the issues that I'm addressing are a bit more universal than just the details of, you know, exactly what happened. I think that when you find the guy on the mountain having to crawl off for 6 days, reporting the same kind of internal emotional states as the man in Auschwitz or the cancer survivor going through chemo like Lance Armstrong does, and you see that all three of these are reporting virtually the same emotional and spiritual transformation that they go through, you know they're not lying about that. I mean, that's just too, it's beyond coincidence for them to make that up, and they would have no motivation to make it up in any event. They're simply reporting what they felt and saw and thought about as they were going through this. So, you know, the physical details of what they went through may be slightly different depending on who's giving the account, but those kind of personal details tend to be pretty reliable.
I only asked because I think sometimes we, as human beings, grope for meaning.
Mm-hmm.
When sometimes the reason person X survived and person Y died might come down to something as capricious as luck. And that's one of the hardest things for us to live with.
Yes, and it can. There are definitely elements of luck in all of these cases. There is always an element of luck in our lives. On the other hand, after reading hundreds and hundreds of accounts and finding things like this, for example, search and rescue people will report over and over again that they'll find somebody lost in the woods who's died of exposure, who has a pack full of equipment that he could have used to keep himself alive. And they look at it and they think, my gosh, what happened here? You know, the guy's dead. He could have just put up his tent or made a fire or whatever. So we know on the one hand there are people who just give up faced with an overwhelming challenge. They crumble. And that leaves the other side of the equation, which are the ones who do successfully get out when they have none of that equipment. So we find people, same situation, lost in the woods, cold and rainy night, and they last for days and days without any equipment. So there's something worth questioning in that to find answers, and that's really what the quest in deep survival is about.
I'm reminded of a joke surrounding the movie Predator. I don't know if you've seen it.
No.
Where a bunch of, I think it's Marines, turn out to be battling an invisible alien.
Mm-hmm.
in a tropical rainforest, and these are all incredibly impressive men, and they are easily picked off one by one, and the last one remaining is the star of the film, Arnold Schwarzenegger. And then, you know, so the question is, well, why did he survive while these other equally muscular Marines did not? And the answer is,
paid more.
Right, because he's the star of the film. One of the things your book really explores is human psychology and the role which emotions play in our lives, and particularly in these kind of situations. You say that emotion is an instinctive response aimed at self-preservation as opposed to human reason, which is something entirely different and which operates in a very different way, and which is sometimes not fully useful or enough in some of these survival situations.
Well, one of the things that I draw on a great deal in the book is recent neuroscience in the last 10 or 15 years that's been able to show us how these different systems in the brain work. And the original system millions of years ago, hundreds of millions of years ago, was essentially the system reptiles had, which is just a bulb on top of the spinal column that controls things like breathing, heart rate, blood pressure, and a few basic reactions like the startle reaction. You know, if you make a loud noise, any animal will react. What evolved from that was a system they call the limbic system, which is the emotional system that allows for a wider range of responses, such as fight or flight responses and mating and, you know, hunting and things like that. It also allows a unique type of communication among mammals in which, through facial expression, body language, and other chemical signals, they're able to tell each other what the internal state of their bodies and moods are. So anyone can recognize a smile, no matter where you come from. It's the same the world over. Darwin discovered this. And so this is a new system. And on top of that new system, another system was built, evolved, called the neocortex, which is what we think we are. It's reason, logic, you know, sequential thought, language, things like that. However, we aren't as logical as we think we are, because the emotional system is very powerful and can easily overwhelm reason in times of high stress, danger, fear, that sort of thing.
Hmm. I am fascinated by what you have to say about fear. You say, for instance, fear is good, too much fear is not.
Right. Well, it's like stress. Any physiologist will tell you that an organism that receives no stress at all doesn't do well. But an organism that receives too much stress doesn't do well either. So there's this midpoint at which you get a little bit of stimulation, but not too much, that you function at your optimum level. So if you deprive people of sensory input, if you deprive infants of sensory input, they'll die, even if you feed them. So fear is like that. I was talking to a fellow who came to me and said, I'm having back surgery, you know, and I'm afraid, and will reading your book help? And I said, sure it will, but, you know, being afraid is good. That means you appreciate the seriousness of what you're involved in. Too much fear, however, makes it impossible for you to think.
I think you talk about how the essence of the matter is the management of fear.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and you find again and again in these survival stories, no matter where they're from, you see people taking fear and turning it into anger at some point in these episodes. They get angry, and it powers them. It sort of overcomes the fear and gives them a motivation to do something. Because taking action is crucial in these survival situations, whether, again, you know, whether you're diagnosed with cancer or you're going through a divorce or you're stuck on a mountain, it's the same thing. You know, you have to perceive your situation correctly. You have to reason through it, make a plan, and then take action.
Right. You talk at one point about how people who seem to be survivors, if we want to call it that, are more apt to be independent thinkers of independent mind and spirit versus those that are really by nature rule followers. Those who follow the rules, who color between the lines, are less apt to survive situations like we're describing.
Yes, and I've heard from a number of different quarters about this since the book came out. Doctors who treat cancer patients are one of the outstanding ones that tell me, you know, the patients who really are going to fight and not give up and survive this thing are really kind of a pain to deal with, because they don't take just anything you tell them. They want to know more. They want to question things. They want to say, well, maybe that's not the right way to go. Lance Armstrong, who we all know won the Tour de France 6 times after recovering from what should have been fatal cancer, describes this kind of thing. He was kind of a pain to the doctors around him, because, you know, he had his own ideas and he fought his own fight. And survivors in the World Trade Center, you know, lots of people there were told by the building security, just stay where you are and we'll come and get you. And they were like, no, I don't think so. I'm out of here. So that, in that case, made the difference between life and death.
Hmm. I want you to explain something else which really jumped off the page at me, which is quite intriguing. You say if you distill all of the psychology, cognitive science, and neuroscience of the last 100 years or so, what you find is that we're always homo, but sometimes not so sapiens.
Right.
Explain what you mean by that.
What I mean by that is that we are primates. We are primates equipped like primates have been equipped for a million years, probably. And our neocortex, this new development that gives us the gift of language and rational thought and all that, is a wonderful thing and a useful thing, but much of our behavior and even much of what we think of as abstract thought begins in our emotional system. And this is beyond the reach of normal consciousness most of the time. So we do things, and we don't know why we do them. There's a neuroscientist named Joseph Ledoux, who I quote in the book, who says, you know, that they discovered that what people do is they do something, they have a behavior, and then they go back and they explain it so that it makes sense in terms of this overall story of their lives. Obviously, there are ways to use reason, and we do it all the time, but just knowing that there are other sources of your behavior that are beyond reason can make you pause and rethink things a little bit in difficult situations and perhaps give you an edge, not sort of trusting all the time that reason is in charge.
Hmm. I think we need to, before we finish, make it clear to listeners that this book, while fascinating on this most fundamental level as the story of survival in talking to mountain climbers and scuba divers and so on, is also, in your view, applicable to the rest of us who do not climb mountains or yeah. or dive to the bottom of the ocean, that we learn something about the human condition which is helpful for all of us.
Well, I agree completely, and our largest audience is not among mountain climbers or people like that. It's among people facing the regular challenges in their life. And I also say, when I go around the country talking to people, that, you know, everybody has a mountain to climb. It's out there waiting for you. Even if it's just the death of a loved one or loss of a job, there's some challenge out there waiting for you that's going to call upon your greatest resources, and it's going to teach you who you are. And you can be prepared for that and take that as a great opportunity in your life for spiritual development, or it can crush you. And that's really the essence of why I wanted to examine these cases, because they give us these amazing examples of how people can deal with really tremendous crises.
The book, again, is called Deep Survival: Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why? True Stories of Miraculous Endurance and Sudden Death, published by W.W. Norton & Company, the author Lawrence Gonzalez. Lawrence Gonzalez, I thank you for writing this fascinating book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
It's been my pleasure.
The time is 8:42, and you're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part 3 is an interview that was originally recorded and broadcast back in 2015. We are entering the wonderful world of Legos for the next few minutes, and we're going to be talking about an actually stupendously beautiful and exciting book called Lego Architecture. And this is a book which celebrates, in a sense, the juxtaposition of those wonderful Lego bricks that so many of us have played with and built with over the years, and with the discipline of architecture. And this book called Lego Architecture is, to a large measure, the brainchild of Adam Reed Tucker, who would be, in all the world, one of less than a dozen Lego-certified professionals who is equipped to design and create the most astonishing recreations of huge structures with Lego bricks. It's really incredible. We're going to find out about how he made the transition from being an architect of actual buildings to this work as a Lego architect. And we'll find out a bit more about the spectacular things one can see in this wonderful book, which celebrates some of the incredible architectural models that have been created with Legos. Again, the book is Lego Architecture. And Adam Reed Tucker, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you for having me.
You dropped quite a bombshell on me just as we began talking before the interview began, when you said that you had just been in the Kenosha area. Explain to our listeners what brought you here.
Well, yeah, as a certified professional, from time to time, you know, when I'm not busy designing for Lego Architecture, I do commissioned works, and the Snap-on Corporation approached me. They wanted one of their new rolling tool cabinets that's about 6 feet wide, 4 foot tall, and 3 feet wide, constructed entirely out of 60,000 Lego bricks, that was going to be used as a display piece at their annual expo down in Florida, and I just got back from doing that, and we achieved the impossible. We took 60,000 bricks and made a working roll cabinet that the drawers slide out, and you could put tools in it, and it was a big hit, and it was a lot of fun working with those guys in Kenosha. They're a great group of people.
You bet. We are very proud of the Snap-on Corporation. They could not be finer citizens of the community, I mean, as a company and individually for that matter. And it's thrilling to hear about your connection with Snap-on.
Yeah.
It's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, thank you.
So you actually, for much of your life, were an architect. And then, in a sense, circumstances kind of ended up shifting your focus in a slightly different direction. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I went to school for architecture, professional degree in architecture, minored in engineering and the philosophy of design theory and art. I was an architect for about 15 to 20 years. And the economy, as you well know, in 2006 really hit the housing market, which affected architects and developers and builders. And we went from a lot of clients down to no clients, and I had to, at this time I was 35 years old, I had to reinvent myself and figure out a new career path, and literally went and had this epiphany of taking Lego bricks and putting them together to recreate world-famous pieces of architecture and celebrating that with the world. And Lego took notice of some of the buildings I was doing. And 6 months later, we formed an agreement to work together to develop a line that we could bring to the world. And now we're celebrating our accomplishments of the last 6 years through this new book published by DK. It's a wonderful visual guide that tells the story of all 20 different models, I believe we're up to, or 18, and the process and how it got started and the techniques and the tips and the tricks and... Yeah, it's a pretty neat book. They did a great job on it.
Yeah, it's really amazing, and this is one of those moments I regret that I'm on the radio. I love radio, except for the lack of pictures in this case is really frustrating. I wish our listeners could be looking at the book as I am right now because it is so spectacular. In the profile about you at the front of the book, mention is made of 9/11 and how that tragedy, among its many effects on us as a society, seems to have, at least for a time, curbed Americans' appetite for tall skyscrapers, understandably so. How does that connect with, in a sense, your professional reversal and also your interest in creating these wonderful Lego models of some of the iconic structures in America and in other places?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought that up. You know, as you get older, you start to realize what are the important things in life, right? Maybe I was a late bloomer and started figuring that out at the age of 35. But the point is that, the world suffered a tragic day on 9/11, and it didn't affect just New Yorkers. But here, being in Chicago, it affected me and a lot of people, and not just the 3,000 lives that were lost that day, but we also lost a couple wonderful buildings and symbols, and those being the Twin Towers. And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to, in my own small way, kind of raise awareness that people did not have to fear tall buildings. You know, tenants were backing out, tourism was down. You know, it just, to me, it was disheartening because people were also fearing flying, if you remember, at that time. And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to illustrate the strength and the marvels that go into the engineering construction and telling a story. And so I put Lego bricks together, and I recreated the original Twin Towers. They were 10 feet tall. They were made out of 50,000 bricks. And I was able to have people come in close and actually understand how the buildings failed because of that tragic event, but more importantly, why they were so strong and why they stood the test of time and people got to enjoy them and cherish them while they were here. And I don't want that to be forgotten. So that was the actual inspiration that motivated me to start thinking along the lines of sharing architecture and raising awareness, if you will.
Hmm. So tell us about that day in 2006 when you visited a branch of Toys R Us, I think. And tell our listeners what you did, how many shopping carts we're talking about, how many Lego bricks we're talking about in order to get all this underway.
Now you're bringing up the embarrassing part of the story.
Oh, not at all. It's great.
So I can be a little compulsive, I guess, and when I've got an idea, maybe that's the entrepreneur in me, right? So I believe after we closed the doors of the firm and I had a few months off to think about things and, you know, I had to get reacquainted with the Lego brick, the Lego product. I mean, when I was a kid, you know, there weren't fancy shapes and colors and all these license sets. I was really unaware of what Lego was up to. So I went one afternoon to a local Toys R Us in Highland Park, Illinois, and I filled up, I believe it was 11 or 13, the number I don't remember. But it was, I think, a bill of close to $8,500. So Christmas came early for me, I guess you could say. And I bought almost every one of every single set. I opened up the boxes, dumped all the parts out, and started playing around with the different shapes and how I could use them in a Kinect. And lo and behold, I started making these sculptures of buildings. And I was like, you know, I think I might be onto something here. And, yeah, that's really how it happened.
Hmm. A really interesting point is made at some point in the book, and I'd never stopped to think about this, that one of the beauties of using Lego bricks to put these kind of amazing models together is that there's nothing to cut, there's nothing to carve, there's nothing to glue, and because of that, this is something that theoretically just about anybody can do. And I really hadn't stopped to think about that it does indeed allow just about anybody to build just about anything. I mean, if they have enough time and determination and imagination and so on. But
you've done your homework, because that's an excellent point. It doesn't require gluing or cutting. The instructions, or the DNA, as I like to refer to it, are automatically built into the bricks. There is a male side and a female side, or studs, or a receiving side, and you can put any part together in any direction, in any way that you want. What is only limiting is your imagination. So, for instance, if I give you a pile of white bricks, and I have the same pile of white bricks, and I ask you to build a square or a cube, the craftsmanship or skill is going to be virtually identical because of the makeup of the brick. That's why I chose this medium. If I were to do metal, like blacksmithing or ceramics, you know, that requires a skill, certainly a skill I don't have and a lot of other people don't have. And so by choosing the Lego brick as my three-dimensional creative medium, not only could I build this, but someone else can be inspired to do the same thing, because the only thing that's separating us at that point is our imagination. It's not our skill.
Hmm. So help us understand that creative process by which you take something like the Empire State Building or the Guggenheim Museum in New York City, or maybe of great interest to folks in this part of the country who know a lot about Frank Lloyd Wright, something like Falling Water. What is that process by which that real-life three-dimensional structure becomes a model built with Legos? What is that process like, and does it vary drastically from project to project? That is, the process itself.
Yeah, that's a great question as well. The process does vary. There's a lot of driving forces behind the process. You know, are we looking for a particular price point? Are we looking for a particular piece count? But at the end of the day, truthfully, it's about the building and how can it be realized out of Lego bricks. So the building really tells us, or dictates to us, what the real scale of the model is going to be. So the part of the design process, for me at least, is I'm a minimalist, and I'm not trying to fool anybody that this is an exact replica or carbon copy. I'm trying to use the brick and also celebrate what the brick is, but at the same time telling a story. So for me, it's about capturing the essence of a structure into its pure sculptural form. So if it's almost like if you look at a building and you kind of squint your eyes and you kind of, you know, see the silhouette, or in this, you know, the case that you brought up with the Empire State Building, and you see the Art Deco, you know, I don't get caught up into the materials or the texturing, but in the model of the Empire State Building, as you've probably already read in the new book, it actually shows how I've used certain elements to capture certain details, so it still looks and obviously has the feel of the Empire State Building, but I don't get bogged down in the details because there is obviously a limit with using this medium that you can only achieve. And so, again, the process, to answer your question specifically, it's really a minimalist approach in capturing the essence of the structure into its pure design.
Hmm. Well, I mean, in other words, capturing the most sort of iconic elements. What is it that makes Big Ben look like Big Ben?
Right.
Aside from every single detail.
The prominent features, yes, right, that are recognizable by, you know, most everybody.
Right. And I should think that there is something really valuable about, first of all, about you or whoever would be the designer sort of sorting that out. I mean, that you learn a lot about the great structures in our world just by engaging in that process. And likewise, somebody either by just seeing one of these models or maybe better yet constructing it also comes to an understanding, a better understanding of some of those fundamentals.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that goes without saying, for sure. It's a great study of what is successful and in some cases what's maybe not so successful. But when you start peeling away the layers of what the architect intended, you start to understand maybe sometimes it's not always, you know, form follows function, but maybe sometimes it's, you know, function follows form.
Mm.
And Frank Lloyd Wright would probably agree with me.
Right. Be interesting to know what he would think of this, or for that matter, any of the architects whose work is represented here with iconic structures like the Eiffel Tower or the Sydney Opera House. I appreciated the fact that at some point in the book it's mentioned that with some of these models, it would perhaps be really difficult to know what's the front and what's the back when you're at certain points early on in the process. So sometimes with actually hidden bricks, certain colors are used that ultimately aren't even visible when the structure is finished, the model is finished, but it helps in the building process. And it's probably a really good idea to think about the average Joe Blow who might be building one of these models to make it buildable.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So not only is it the process of designing the finished model, but then the real hard work comes into designing the instructions or the reverse engineering of the model. So anyone in the world could, you know, read the instructions clearly, understand, you know, the steps and the order of which the sequence of events take place to eventually construct the model. And all of that is highly calculated and thoroughly thought through. And we've gotten really good at now fine-tuning that whole process of just the building instructions, which, truthfully, is an art in and of itself.
Well, it's really an amazing book, and I, for one, am excited to share this with my niece of all persons, my fourth-grade-aged niece, who absolutely loves to put together some of these Lego kits, some of which are incredibly intricate. I mean, even if it's just the speedboat or the little beach scene or whatever it is, there are all kinds of things that a child learns and skills that they foster when they work their way through some of these models.
Yeah, that's what it's about. It's about, you know, sharing that experience with somebody else. Perfect. Love it.
So this beautiful book, again, is called Lego Architecture, and it includes all kinds of stunning photographs plus all kinds of sort of behind-the-scenes information about the construction of all kinds of Lego models for all kinds of different structures, including our own White House, the Empire State Building, the Space Needle, a few structures from around the world. And I suppose this work goes on. There's always more structures to be creating as models.
It does, absolutely.
So we watch for the future of all this with great interest. And in the meantime, Adam Reed Tucker, we appreciate you joining us today on The Morning Show, and we wish you happy building in the years ahead.
Thank you as well.
Tomorrow on the morning show, my newly recorded interview with Mark Freeman, the author of a book called Modern Family. It's an oral history of the groundbreaking sitcom that has delighted audiences for 11 seasons. That will be on tomorrow's morning show.